The commentaries that tell us how the discourses weave into the Buddha's biography, they don't list the discourses in chronological order, other than these first three that we just looked at and the last one. So there's a whole mess of discourses in the middle, you know, like thousands, that we don't know exactly when they were given. There's various clues in them, and so then, you know, some scholars have, you know, pieced together a rough timeline. But the first three is really a famous set. So we just talked through those first three the last few weeks. The setting in motion, the wheel of the Dhamma, in which the Buddha taught to his five ascetic friends the middle path between sensual indulgence and bodily mortification, and how that path is expressed in the Noble Eightfold Path, which is the fourth of the Four Noble Truths. So in that first text, the Buddha announces the middle path and the Four Noble Truths, the truth of dukkha, or dissatisfaction, the truth of craving, or the cause of dukkha, the truth of the end of dukkha, the cessation of dukkha, through the cessation of craving, and then the path to that end, which is the Noble Eightfold Path. As the Buddha is giving this first discourse, his friend Kondanya has the first insight into the Dhamma, other than the Buddha himself, and exclaims, "Everything that has a beginning has an end." And with that exclamation, he is announcing his stream entry. This is the first insight that opens what's called the Dharma eye. And so this is, as I talked about when we looked at this first discourse, the Buddha doesn't give a teaching on impermanence. He gives a teaching on craving and dissatisfaction. And what Kondanya understands through hearing that, and particularly he gives a teaching on dissatisfaction, craving, and the end of dissatisfaction. And that's important. So the third noble truth, don't ever forget the third noble truth, right? We talk so much about suffering and so much about craving, and everyone's a little bit like, yeah, cessation, maybe me, not me, someday, some lifetime. Let's talk more about suffering. The third noble truth is where it's at, right? And so what Kondanya gets is everything that has a beginning has an end. And this, I think, flows out of the noble truths in a beautiful way. First of all, we can understand from the first three noble truths that suffering has an end. This should be really good news, right? Suffering, dukkha, ends. And it ends particularly because it has a cause. This maybe seems obvious to you. Maybe you have already entered the stream. It was not obvious to folks at the time, and it's not obvious to many of us in our internal psyches. One of the things that's most sticky about suffering is that it seems like it's going to go on and on and on and on, especially the really intense forms like chronic pain and heartbreak and the feeling of loss or loneliness, or the suffering that comes from pervasive and repetitive mind states, addictive mind states, mild, medium, and intense. All the forms of dis-ease in the body-mind that really stick around. And of course, the systemic kinds of suffering. You know, if you're born into a disadvantaged social class or gender class or something else, it might really seem like that suffering doesn't change, like it doesn't cease, you know. And so the Buddha saying there is a cause to suffering. Suffering is not a function of the universe, you know, that's inevitable, and therefore it's just what you get. You're gonna suffer. That's not the message, actually. You don't have to. It's a feature of the deluded mind that we find ourselves in, that we are invited to wake up out of. But it's not a feature of the universe. It's not even it's not even necessarily a feature of the kind of animal that we are. Apparently there have been enlightened beings, Buddhas and Arahants and Pratyeka Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, over and over again through all of time and space. It's actually it's a not uncommon thing for enlightened beings to be around, right? The Buddha is not the first Buddha. There have been dozens. The Arahants are not the first Arahants. There have been dozens, thousands, you know, an infinite number, because there's no conceivable beginning to the universe. There's no noticeable beginning. Maybe not no conceivable. The Buddha says there's no observable beginning. That's actually more technically correct. You could conceive of it, but you would just be making something up, like the creation myths make something up. The Buddha, in fact, makes fun of a creation myth of his time. There's creation myths from the Vedic tradition, the Brahmanic tradition, that talk about a creator god, that is sometimes called Brahma and sometimes called other things, who creates the universe. And the Buddha actually tells a kind of actually tells a story about the creation of the universe. It's a parody of that, exposing it as being deluded. And it goes a little bit like this. This is a tangent, but this is early Buddhist humor. The Buddha says, you know, once upon a time, in a very rarefied heaven realm, a heavenly being died. And they were reborn in the immediate lower heaven realm. And one of the things about the heaven realms is that they are increasingly subtle as you go up. Up is a metaphor, but there's a bunch of them, and they are increasingly subtle. And beings on any particular level can see, perceive, feel, observe beings on lower levels, but you can't perceive beings on levels higher than you. You can perceive beings that are less subtle than you, but not beings that are more subtle. This is often true, right? You can see things that you already understand because you've either been through those or somehow understand them, but you don't really understand things you don't understand. You don't really know what it's like to be a subtler kind of being than you are. So, a being in a certain god realm dies and is reborn in the immediate lower god realm. So they can't see the god realm above. At first, when they are born there, they can only see an empty space, because as it turned out, randomly, all the other beings who used to live there have also recently died. And this being just happens to be the first being who's reborn in this currently empty space. Right? You get born in an empty house. You have no idea that lots of people have lived there before. So you're like, empty house. And the Buddha says, this divine being looks at the empty house, notices that they're the only one there, and says, aha, I'm the only one here. I must be the creator god, who is the first being in the universe. And then other beings die from places, and they get born there, and they appear. And this creator god says, oh, I'm the first one here. I must be the creator of all these. Right? So this is the Buddha super poking fun at the Brahmins and being like, oh, you've got this whole myth about this like divine creator god. That creator god, the Buddha is insulting Brahma, right? The Godhead himself, the creator of all things. That's got some, chutzpah to it. for the Buddha to really do that. There's no beginning to the universe. The Buddha is saying, like, no, there's no creator God. Nobody knows how this thing started, right? It just goes on and on and on, birth and death, endless rebirth. And so the Buddha gives this extraordinary claim at the beginning that dukkha, dissatisfaction, suffering, has an end. And it ends when you uproot the thing that's causing it. And what we have here is a vision of the universe that is entirely a system, a complex system of causes and effects, causes and conditions leading to effects and fruits. There's not some initial creator being that is outside the causative process. Everything is immersed in this. And therefore, there was no chicken before egg, no egg before chicken. No conceivable beginning can be found to the round of birth. So the Buddha gives this teaching that dukkha has an end, and Kundanya abstracts that, I think, to everything, because there's the flip side, right? Craving is this feeling in the heart mind that wants something intensely, and it wants in a way that implies a desire for permanence, right? Because why would I want something? I want because I either don't have, I have had in the past and it's gone and I want it again, or I have it now and I'm afraid of losing it, therefore I want it to sustain. And so in both kinds of craving, wanting something that's not here and wanting something that's here to sustain, there's a desire for things, something to last. And in a way, I think here's part of what Kundanya understands, that it's not just a desire for things to last, but there's actually a kind of belief that it should be possible for them to last. Right? Because if I really understood that nothing lasts, wanting would be revealed as you know, like hopeless from the get-go. Like, what am I even doing investing this much emotional energy in something that is so temporary? You know, like, you know, and there's, it's like, you know, you can invest a lot of emotional energy in building a sandcastle. You could get really into it for the afternoon, right? You've got one tidal cycle, basically, you know, 6 hours. And you build your sandcastle, and it's possible to really delight in building it, to get really into making it complicated, all of this. I just saw a picture a couple of days ago that there was the winner of a sand sculpture competition on some beach somewhere recently. The sand sculptures are, you know, ridiculously complicated. Somebody had done a sand sculpture of the Lincoln Memorial, of Lincoln sitting in his chair, that huge statue. But this one has the whole statue slightly crumbling, and Lincoln has his head in his hands, like, political statement. So you can invest a lot into building a sandcastle, but you probably, and, you know, spoiler alert, if you don't know this yet, but you know, I'm teasing you, adults. Hello, adults. You all know that no matter how much energy and effort you invest in your sandcastle, when the tide comes in, it gets washed away. And perhaps you've had the good fortune to have to explain this to a child at some point. And I think it's a really great moment, right? Like, and it doesn't work to build the castle, you know, way high up on the dry part of the beach, because then you have to carry all the water up there to make the sand won't form up there. You could actually only can build a castle in the danger zone, right? That's the only place you can really build it. And then you're going to lose it, right? It's going to be gone the next day. And it's a developmental step to really grok that and to learn to be okay with that. And one of the possible conclusions to this is to decide that it's not worth building it at all. right? And you can make that choice, right? That's a classic renunciate choice, right? All right, enough with sandcastles. I don't bother building things that are so ephemeral. And you can do, you know, you could do a different maneuver. You know, the that is suggested here. You know, which is the like, it can be beautiful to watch the waves slowly take it, right? There's a beauty in impermanence. One of my writer inspirations, Rebecca Solnit, wrote a book called Orwell's Roses. And for a while she was promoting it, she was posting photographs of roses. And she posted a whole series of decaying roses at one point. And photos from a beautiful visual artist who's done these extraordinary photos of decaying roses, and, you know, really encouraging us to see the beauty in every phase of the life cycle, right? And you see this sometimes in folks who have made the object of their art photographing or painting very old people, who our American society at least often dismisses, right, as no longer beautiful, and, which is absurd, but it's a common delusion. One of the responses to impermanence can be to learn how to value every phase of a thing. I think that's a really intelligent and heartfelt and beautiful response. But what we have then is two sides of the teaching on impermanence enfolded in the Noble Truths. Dukkha, this pain that we suffer from, the fact that birth is dukkha, aging is dukkha, death is dukkha, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are dukkha. Getting something you didn't want is dukkha. Not getting what you want is dukkha. In short, the five grasping aggregates or the focuses of the grasping mind are dukkha. That's the first noble truth. The fact that that ends, third noble truth says, the cessation of dukkha through the cessation of craving. So first of all, the reminder, your pain will end. And then this, the implications in the teaching on craving is that the pleasant also ends, right? Craving is the corollary of the truth that which is pleasant ends. And so the unpleasant ends and the pleasant ends. And so I think that Kondanya gets both of these, right? And you have to get both sides of it. You can't just hang on to the fact that the unpleasant is going to end, because then you might unconsciously still crave for a state of permanent attainment of something. You know, I got some kind of immortality, or you know, I got my sweetheart forever. I got married to the right person, and, you know, happily ever after. Here we go, right? You might have that kind of romantic ideal that the pleasant will sustain. And you can't just focus on the other, that like, oh, the pleasant is impermanent. Because you can get nihilistic, like, oh, everything good, just all the sandcastles dissolve into the ocean, everything good crumbles and rots, nothing means anything, right? So if you only focus on the impermanence of the pleasant, you can get pretty dour, you know, on life. And if you only focus on the impermanence of the dissatisfaction, you can grasp, right? So Kondanya gets both and then exclaims, everything that has a beginning has an end. You might think that exclamation would be everything is impermanent, or all formations are impermanent. That's how it's stated often in the texts, in other places. And it's how we state it in the morning puja, in the chant. All phenomena are impermanent. That phrase is sabbe sankhara anicca, right? Anicca, impermanence. The way that Kondanya actually says it, and the way that several people in the early discourses say it, when someone exclaims that insight into impermanence that is stream entry. The translation I'm using tonight, everything, anything that has a beginning has an end. That's Bhikkhu Brahmali's translation from the translator of the Vinaya on Sutta Central, a beautiful monastic. In Pali, it's Yang Kinchi Samudaya Dhammang. So Samudaya is beginning, and a Dhamma is a thing or an experience. So any experience, Yam Kinchi, anything at all, experience, Dhamma, Samudaya, any experience that has a beginning, Sabam Tam Nirodha Dhamman, Nirodha cessation Dhamma. So any phenomena that has a beginning is also a phenomena that has cessation, Nirodha, that has an end. And so really linking together the arising and the passing away of anything. So to really see that. So the Buddha gives this first discourse to his friends. Kondanya has this insight, everything that has a beginning has an end. He understands the relationship between craving and dukkha and cessation, the first three noble truths. In the second discourse, the Buddha presses further with these first five, gives them the discourse on the not self teaching. This really opens up that initial insight into impermanence, into what it implies about what comes to be called the three characteristics of dukkha, anicca, and anatta. So everything is impermanent because it's impermanent, but we crave it and grasp it, then there is suffering. So there's these two characteristics of impermanence and suffering or dissatisfaction. And the corollary is that because it's impermanent, it can't be considered a self or a possession of mine. It's important here to remember that the self doesn't mean personality, and it doesn't mean like that you are not a distinct person. It just means you're not immortal, really. It means there's not a thing here that outlasts the body, outlasts every condition of your life, is unchangeable through all the conditions of your life. So it has been exactly the same from the moment of your birth through the moment of your death and beyond, in both directions in time, forever, right? Because if there was a thing that is you, and it came into being at the moment of your birth and disappears at the moment of your death, then the suggestion is, how could that be yourself? Self is a bad translation here for the word atta. I like soul better, actually. I think that this teaching really is saying that beings don't have permanent immortal souls, that what they have is this moment in time, this lifetime, where we are participating in a constantly unfolding complex process. And as part of that process, self-consciousness arises. I have a sense that I am somebody. You are somebody. I am somebody. That somebody is a sense based on the conditions around me. People treat me like an individual. I am in a certain way an individual. That doesn't imply anything metaphysical about us. That doesn't, just because I am a distinct person and you are distinct people, doesn't mean that we have something personal and unique that outlasts us forever in both directions, that was here before you were born and will continue after you're dead. The changing process of things just keeps rolling on, right? And in that sense, if you really get that, the proposal is that really pulls an important peg out of fear of death. Because in a certain way, fear of death is hooked to over-identification with the life path of this body. This is really me. That if we get that this body and this mind and heart and all of its content are responsive to the world around us in a constant and changing way, And that it's the nature of organic bodies to die, whatever we call die, right? For consciousness to leave the body, for the body to become earth again, for consciousness to go wherever consciousness goes. Maybe it disperses into the ecosystem. Maybe it goes into another womb and, you know, continues in a way that feels personal. But it's not the same being, right? There's not a soul that jumps from body to body or from body into ecosystem. And so in that second teaching, the Buddha says, nothing that you can observe or pin down could be called yourself. And the argument that he uses there is that if it qualified for being a self or a soul, you'd be able to control it. Anything that you could call, this is me, what would the definition of that be other than that you had some volitional control over it? Right? I could pick anything in the universe. Like, I could say, oh, space itself, right? The volume of all that is, that's me. You could say that. That's cool. Identify with that. Why call it myself rather than calling it anything else? The only way I could call it myself in a certain way is that if I feel like I have a hand in it, you know? And the Buddha, I think, is saying that we are as deluded as that deity that came to be called Brahman, you know? Oh, I have some kind of self-consciousness. I must be the, you know, the great immortal one who has control. But I'm not making any of this happen. Right? This is not myself. And I can't make my body be the way I want it to be, right? It's getting, I'm losing my, you know, I'm losing my, the physical skills that I had when I was doing a lot of difficult yoga. At the moment, I have a whole bunch of random or not random injuries. I got crazy poison oak chopping down trees in the gully with my kid a couple weeks ago. It's still here. I have kind of a gnarly face injury that's not very visible, but actually there's some nerve damage. I fell in the forest last weekend, climbing over some crazy log thing with my kid, and my back is all scraped up. My beard is grayer than it used to be. Like all these things, right? No matter what I might wish of them, and for the record, I don't mind the beard. I don't love being all scraped up, and the poison oak is the worst. But you know, for the record, I don't think I'm in charge of this body. You know, I suggest some directions, and then it does its thing. You know. Many months ago, I suggested the direction of walking up the stairs of my house, and I happened to trip on them and jam my pinky, and I think I broke it, and it still hurts 6 months later. You know, it's like you do your best, and then the body has the experience that it has, you know? And then this is true about everything. So you're just not in control. And so the Buddha says, that is prime evidence for why this is not a self. So he gives that teaching, none of these things, your form, your feelings, try controlling your feelings, you know, your perceptions, your mental formations, your stories, your narratives, you know. Can you hear that barking? Is that coming through? It's the foxes. That's the yelp of the fox outside. The Buddha gives the teaching on not self. None of those things can be considered yourself. And that teaching brings all the rest of the five, Kondanya and the other four, all to full awakening. Like, that's the thing that does it. They're all there. The third discourse that we talked about last week was the fire discourse. The Buddha has converted a handful of people since that first one, and in the fire discourse, he converts three powerful ascetic teachers and their 1,000 followers, who have all been practitioners of fire sacrifice, and gives them the teaching that everything is burning with the fires of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, and in the course of that, also, you know, those teachers have this same opening: everything that has a beginning has an end. So I love these early insights that the Buddha sets up the conditions for, and then these first practitioners realize them. And this insight, everything that has a beginning has an end, suggests that, so we talked a little bit about how they arise naturally out of the Noble Truths and out of this initial teaching, like notice what's not yours. Notice, you know, how suffering works, how grasping works, right? How pleasure and pain work. And to go all the way back to the middle way, notice the relationship, you know, notice how sensual pleasures work as a source for happiness, like not very well. Notice how torture of yourself works as a method for happiness, not very well. It turns out that the thing that works is being deeply oriented toward your actions, toward ethics. The Eightfold Path is really an ethics path, right? Ethics grounds the meditative path. Really notice that, like, oh, in a world where everything passes, where everything that arises passes away, what should we do about that? Like, how do you actually practice with that? Right? The Eightfold Path says, well, the first limb, right, view, says, see the world in terms of the Noble Truths. So we're on that tip right now. So stick with that. Hold dissatisfaction and craving in your attention. Now, make an intention in relation to that. So knowing that and not yet being liberated, not yet having the insight into impermanence, what should we do? And the Buddha says, well, create an intention. So orient your mind in the direction of these things, in the direction of letting go. That one falls pretty directly off of the craving teaching. And then toward non-hatred, right? Which I think in a certain way is an internal or an emotional kind of letting go. What is hatred other than clinging to a negative perception of someone else? Let go of that projection, that the hatred, and then let go of the actions that could come from that hatred, which is causing harm. So let go of hurting beings. So the intention toward harmlessness, toward kindness, and toward renunciation. Those are the three wise intentions, second limb of the path, right?
It can also be fear, right? Fear and aversion as sort of twins that give rise to hatred, absolutely, absolutely. And from those intentions, the precepts arise, you know? How do we care for each other? Not taking life, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, not lying, using harsh speech, not misusing intoxicants. And the Eightfold Path says it this way: tend to your speech, tend to your relational actions, and tend to your livelihood. So you're really not harming beings in a large scale way through the kind of work you do in the world. That's just set yourself up for success. You know, and don't be a butcher, an arms dealer, a gambler, you know, a swindler, a thief. And then it says, having done that, then orient yourself toward wholesome states. Right, limb six, wise effort. Cultivate wholesome states, diminish unwholesome states. And then give rise to mindfulness and concentrate the mind, or learn how to enter states of deep
immersion in samadhi. If this is the path, and the path is for the uprooting of craving, I want to feel into how we, at the moment in this room, mostly modern lay people, how do we do this? Not just how do we, you know, walk the path, we're always talking about that, but in what way exactly would practicing be liable to give rise to this insight that everything that has a beginning has an end? How do we get to that? What's the key to unlock that insight? Because I think it's easy, and there's a certain obviousness to impermanence, and even to all this talk of like how craving leads to dissatisfaction. There's a surface level where we get that. Okay, I get that. I see that. I have a felt sense or an observing sense of how addictive mind states work, of how, you know, the sort of romantic grasping works, how lust works, how greed works. And I can have that, and I can have a kind of basic observation sense that impermanence is, that's accurate, right? Like, oh yeah, I things don't last. If impermanence is relatively obvious and the painfulness of greed is obvious, why don't we have that insight? Why doesn't it hit us like it hit Anyakundanya and the others? Oh, everything that has a beginning has an end. Does anything shift for you if we phrase it in that way, right? The way that saying all conditioned things are impermanent, it's a little bit dry, but there is like impermanent has a certain tone to it, right? It's a teaching. Nothing is permanent. Disabuse yourself of the idea, the feeling that things are permanent. But there's this different phrase, everything that has a beginning has an end, right? All Dhamma, which means things, but it also means experiences. Let's go with experiences right now. All experiences that start end. Can I feel how that is speaking to my deeper cravings? Right? What is the thing that needs to be liberated? You know, I get it. Something like about, you know, craving for sensual experiences, certain kinds of craving. And I even can kind of see this bit about the not self. How like, oh, if it was mine, I'd be able to control it. It's not mine, therefore, I can't control it, therefore it's not mine. I sort of get that. Why don't I enter the stream? Like, what's here? And I think part of what there is here is that there are layers of grasping, essentially, that are really the lattice work of my sense of self and my sense of how the world works and how it is to be in it, that it's quite hard to get to. I can say, I can see that everything passes. I can see that this is not myself. And that can be real. And it cannot touch this core piece. In the experience of stream entry, what's called stream entry, sotapanna is the term. A sotapanna is one who has entered the stream of the Dhamma. One of the fetters or deep constrictions of the heart that falls away with stream entry is called sakkaya ditti, personality view. And it is this idea that the thing I experience as my surface personality, you know, which could be livelihood, identification, I'm a teacher of this, I'm a writer of this, I'm a, you know, it could be role identification, I'm a father, it could be, you know, something on another channel, you know, it could be, you know, I'm male, I'm queer, I'm leftist, I'm, you know, it could be I'm angry, you know, it could be I'm haunted, it could be I'm addicted, it could be, you know, it could be I'm a mod Gen X punk who's trying to
you know, recover from late stage capitalism, like whatever you identify with. That's enough vulnerability for the night. Thank you very much. It's all true. Whatever you identify with, right? All of that, we call it personality, right? That there's a view that that's me. And that the more I unconsciously take refuge in that view, the more a certain amount of suffering is going to be inevitable, right? Because that's a grasping. None of those things are permanent, right? It may well be true that I am no longer, you know, a mod, right? That was a style that was current in about 1984, and I was in it. This is not mod. Meh, you know? It certainly wouldn't be to my 13-year-old self that was wearing those pointy-toed leather shoes, right? And so where'd that mod kid go, right? He's gone. There's, you know, memory is not the same as identity. I'm not that being anymore. And I think that, you know, when Kundanya understands that everything that has a beginning has an end, what that means is that the twin teaching on the impermanence of the pleasant and the impermanence of the unpleasant touches all the way into that lattice work of the perceived self. Oh, this is who I think I am. And suddenly it's like, oh, even that thing that feels like home, feels like me, and it even feels like I value it and I am it. You know, even if I think I can't control it, but actually I'm still trying, you know, I know that I can't control the body, but actually I just want to lose a few pounds and regain a little bit of muscle tone. Good luck, right? Maybe you do for a little while, right? But we get so hooked into, in a very unconscious way, I'm going to take control again. I'm going to regain control of my life. You know, I'm going to be the person I think I am. And that's powerful, and it's quite subtle. So you could spend your whole life doing that, and it could even be quite fulfilling, but it's not going to be a liberation from dukkha. Because dukkha is built into the very perception of being a self or a soul or a personality or an individual at all. And so our puzzle, I think, is to figure out how to, I'm not even sure it's a figuring out, it might be more mystical than that, but I'm going to say figure out how to allow the message of the teachings, the message of the Dhamma, to soak through our being, to actually get down to those layers that are the matrix of our being, right? To soak through, of course, that means they have to get through a fair amount of body armor and attachment wounding and cultural malaise and, you know, layers of rigidity. Yeah, thank you, Julie. Blessings. Good night. Yeah, we'll wrap in a moment. How do we let them soak through so that they can actually moisten and, you know, dissolve a bit that what's really an armored layer of the idea of the self, the idea of the fixated self. This is who I am. And as they do that, then we can exclaim, you know, oh, everything that has a beginning has an end, right? That phase of my life where I was a, you know, disaffected mod, I know how it began because I can feel where loneliness came from in my being, and I could feel where, you know, the drama of being,
that way arose as an appropriate response to the world in that time. That was the first Reagan term here. It was a really good time to grow your hair long and hate everything and wear pointy toed boots and listen to really unhappy English people sing songs about being, lonely and all alone. That was great. Everything that thing had a beginning, right? It came out of causes. And the beginnings in my life had to do with my childhood, and the beginnings in England had to do with the long fallout of the British Empire and a million other things, right? And the death of disco and the end of the civil rights era and the beginning of the neoliberal collapse. You could take any channel you want. You can find the beginning of something. And it ended, right? That phase ended. Everything that has a beginning has an end. Every part of your personality arose from some conditions, and it has either ended or is in the process of changing based in conditions. And I think the more that we can let this soak in, the more we actually experience, I think, a kind of profound, I think the pathway to stream entry, it passes through an area of profound vulnerability, really. A bunch of these ascetics, the Buddha's friends, I'll end here. The Buddha's friends, the five friends, and then he converts a bunch of wealthy people, lay people, and then he goes back and converts these 1,000 fire-worshipping ascetics. These ascetics were people who had, they were ordained people. A whole bunch of the early Sangha were ordained in other traditions. So these are people who have a strong identity doing something. They've already taken up a strong identity. They've grown long dreadlocks. They have all this paraphernalia. They have a whole religious and social and cultural place. Not to mention the fact that when you get ordained in the Buddhist system, you lose your caste. So some of these people were actually they were Brahmins. They're at the top of the caste system and they lose it, right? To join the Buddha's order means, in a very overt, conscious, social way, ending everything that you think you've become. And so I think this is built in, really, that, to enter the stream means dying to all of these identities that you have been fixated on in the past. And the pathway to getting there has to be a kind of ritual, liminal space. That's why there's an ordination ritual. And when you enter that space, you enter, as you do in all life change rituals, life phase shifting rituals, you enter a liminal space where you're neither, Victor Turner's phrase, betwixt and between states. You're not a member of the community. You're not who you were. You're not who you're going to become. You're kind of floating. And you have to be reconstituted into a new thing. Right, the monastic or the layperson who has gone for refuge. You do it in a ritual way so that you come out the other side with a different identity, right? And that identity is now not a fixated self. It's the identity of Sangha and of refuge, of gone for refuge. So how do we let that process actually be made real in us? So that the water, the saving, that the nectar of the Dhamma can actually kind of percolate down, soak down through ourselves to those places that need it the most, that are hard to let go of, but we can, and then we might exclaim that everything that has a beginning has an end. All right, good. Pausing there. Every talk that has a beginning has an end. It's 5 after. I'll do as I've been doing, the formal close, and then I'll stick around for questions or responses as needed for a few minutes. Blessings to each of us. May the merit of our practice together be for the benefit of all, for all beings near and far, past and future, born and to be born. May our lives be a celebration of the truth. And may we realize that freedom that is the birthright of sentient beings to awaken fully beyond birth and death. May the Dharma eye open. Right. So thank you for your presence, your support of this group.